Good morning. This is Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Kathy Converse. I serve for a few more weeks as your treasurer, and I'm on the board and the program committee. So welcome this morning and for this opportunity to be together. Certainly it's spring. It's very tempting to be outside, not inside. Prayer is where we come to learn about being more human, to learn more about being in a relationship together, how to listen, how to forgive, how to be vulnerable, how to create trust and compassion in one another, and how to live in a socially justice manner. We welcome people from all races, ethnicities, sexual orientations, abilities and inabilities, family structures, and religious backgrounds, or no religious background. Our services are led by members of the Prairie or outside speakers, as we will enjoy today. Our opening words, the task of the religious community. The central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There's a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures us that we're not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together our vision widens and our strength is renewed. Mark Morrison Reed. Now we'll do the challenge. Life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and the mysteries of this great gift. Marjorie Montgomery. Today I have the pleasure of welcoming back Rob Brink. Seems like when Rob Brink comes to visit us, I'm up here. So nice to welcome back a friend. Rob graduated from the Minnesota Bible College and earned his Master's of Divinity degree at the University of Dubuque Theological Seminary. He served for 15 years as a minister in both the states of Wisconsin and Michigan until 2014. These are in Rob's words. During that time, he moved further and further left until he fell off the edge. In the process, he lost his faith, his career, and his marriage. He comes to us today with a smile on his face because a man with nothing left to lose sees opportunity everywhere. Today, Rob lives and works in Janesville on a real job, but his joy is still preaching. As a regular guest speaker at the Freethought Congregation of Sauk City, Rob gets to channel those old preacher skills into a new mindset working toward a new goal, a humanist community. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you very much. It is an absolute pleasure to be back. What are the big issues we're facing in the world today? I'm totally okay with talking back. That's it. We got four and we're done. The world is full of issues. So my second question for you today is, what's holding us back from solving those issues? Is it that we don't know how to fix the issue? Or is it that we can't get everybody to do the thing? Yes, well, it's a little of both, but it's mostly the people, right? Yeah. The issue is the people, 90% of the time. We gotta figure things out. And the biggest thing we gotta figure out is how to deal with other people. How do we change someone else's mind? Now, I wish I had an easy, perfect answer here. I don't. But I do have some good ideas, because changing people's minds is kind of my thing. I'm a recovering dictator. Served for 15 years as a paid professional clergy person whose job was to change people's minds. It's what I was paid to do. And then I changed my mind. So I've got it from both sides, a little experience. What I've come to understand is that changing people's minds is very, very difficult. And the reason for that, one of the many reasons for that, is that we are not as rational or independent as we believe that we are. We are brains in cases, on stilts, and these brains, by necessity, are as efficient as possible. And the fastest way to figure things out is not to determine whether or not this particular chair can support my weight, is to watch whether all of you sat on a chair without checking it. I work in a big box with 2,000 other people. I don't have to go out and figure out what the weather's like outside. I just watch the people coming in. The heuristic that's built into our brains that works most of the time is, what do the people that kind of look like me kind of think about the thing? That's how we work. We don't check. We don't figure it out. We just look and say, eh, okay. And that's good because it's efficient. Most of the time, that's entirely good enough. The problem is, it means that a lot of what we think, we justify post hoc, and a lot of what we think is built out of our identity rather than a rational choice. So the big question is not, how do I change someone's mind? It's, how do I change someone's identity? Which is huge. And again, it's a thing that I went through. I don't have an easy answer here because no one has an easy answer here, which is a good, good thing, because if we knew how to alter someone else's identity, Coca-Cola would have already done it. Our governments and our corporations, you think they would not take advantage of that social manipulation technology? Absolutely they would. They would alter our identities in a second if they could. It is good news that we are opaque to ourselves and to each other. It is really good news that influence is more an art than a science. So what I offer today is not the answer. It's my story. This is how I changed my identity. Some Christians will tell you that your Christianity only counts if you made a choice. They'll say, are you a real believer? What was the day you became a believer? My answer back is, what was the day you first believed in the Son? Can you tell me the day that you decided to believe in the Son? If you can't tell me that day, then you understand exactly why I can't tell you the day I became a Christian. It's just what was. I grew up in it. It was my life. It was my family. It was my community. It was as steady and reliable and predictable as necessary as the sun. I didn't have to choose. It's just what was. Because I grew up in a church, I grew up in a youth group. My youth group leaders were a husband and wife team. She was the lead and he was the backup. They were Robert and Penny Blanchard. And Robert and Penny had a standing rule. They said, if you ever happen to be in the area, just ring the bell and come on up. They lived in an apartment. And I was on their paper route. So I'd get on my rollerblades, get on my big stack of papers, and I would fold them flat so that I could, you got the door back there, I wouldn't have to, like, lazy person, walk all the way up here and put it down. No. I would start back here, and I would be flying. And I'd hit the doors, and they bounce, and they land. It was awesome. That has absolutely nothing to do with the story. It's just one of the proudest things I've ever done. So after I get done winging newspapers all over the place, I would stop at Robert and Penny's place. Ring the bell, come on up. And they would say, oh, so good you're here. Come on in. Sit down. Have a Mountain Dew. How's your day? What are you doing? So this is how we lived. And it was amazing. And then one day, I showed up at their house, rang the bell, came upstairs, and Penny was not at her best, because Penny had decided to kick her Mountain Dew habit. So Penny looked up and she said, Hi, Rob. You can just sit over here, and if you want a Mountain Dew, I'm sorry, we don't have any anymore. So how was your day? And I'm like, I'm sorry. You look like you're in pain. Well, I got a headache, but I'm okay. How are you? And we're talking, and I look over, and usually Robert's sitting right there with us at the table talking about me. But he wasn't. He was over here at the other table working on the taxes. And he couldn't even, like, speak to me. He was so frustrated figuring out what went in which form where. And I sat and I talked. And then the conversation kind of petered out. We sat in the quiet, and I realized for the first time in my life that these people were not superhuman Christians. They were just people. And that every time I just randomly showed up at their house, it wasn't because they were waiting for me. It was because they were nice. They weren't super Christians. They were just people who were trying to be the best people they could be, and they made room in their life for me, and I thought, if they can do that, I can do that. So I went to college. I went to the same college they went to because I wanted to be just like them. And I blew right past them. I went past evangelical into fundamentalist. You have no idea. Okay. I don't wish I still had it, but I kind of wish I still had it. My teacher, when I graduated, my teacher would save all of the work and she would give it back to us. It's like a portfolio to say, here, you can use this to show when you apply for your first job, you can show all this work that you did. And so I had until recently, a copy of an essay that I wrote about why, five reasons why, three reasons why, homosexuality was equivalent to alcoholism. Oh yeah. I was a ballroom dance instructor and proud of it because it reinforced proper gender roles. The man leads and the woman follows. Oh yeah. So I did the one thing you must never ever do if you want to keep thinking the thing you always thought. I actually tried to live it out in the real world. So I became a minister and I started living with real people, trying to fix real problems, trying to make things happen in a congregation where stuff just happens and you have to figure it out. And guess what? If you ignore half of the people and say, sorry, you don't count, stuff stops happening. You need everyone. You can't treat half of the human race like a substandard citizen and just get stuff done. You have to work together. And people walk in the door and you're like, well, I want to reach out to new members. I want to bring in people from the outside. You can't spew hate and expect to collect a whole lot of new friends. So you have a choice. You can either run a church that actually works with real people that welcomes actual human beings, or you can be right. And I made a choice. And according to my conservative Christian former friends who won't speak to me anymore, that was the day I stopped being a Christian. According to my liberal Christian who still speak to me friends, that was the first day I started actually acting like a Christian. So I decided to go back to school. Went to get a Master of Divinity degree. Yes, you did hear that right. Master of Divinity. You can use that to entertain your friends at parties now. Oh, you met the president? How nice. I met a Master of Divinity. Went, and two classes absolutely changed my life. One was Karl Barth. The other was T.F. Torrance. Now, this is part two of volume four. Part two a volume four, we don't have time to do Bart. But Torrance was built on the work of a philosopher named Michael Polanyi, or Polanyi, I think. And Polanyi is still with me. He talked about epistemology. How do we know the thing we know? How do we claim to actually have knowledge? And the way he explained it, or the way that I summarized what he explained far more better than I could, is imagine, do you guys remember those iBooks, the 3D iBooks? Okay? And, well, some who can do these? Okay, about half, okay. So for the rest of you who can't do it, the way it works is you look past it, and then your eyes, because of the parallax vision, interpret the slight variations as a 3D image. It's the exact same thing that happens in a 3D movie theater. It's just instead of relying on polarized lenses to slightly shift your eyes, you actually are looking past the thing. Who cares? The point is, Polanyi says, if the way knowledge works is just like that book. You can't figure out what the 3D image is by cutting it up into little pieces and figuring out what the ratio is between the blue bits and the red bits and the green bits. You can't figure it out by looking at it and analyzing it very, very carefully. You have to look past it and rest in it and accept that you don't see it and be uncomfortable and live in the tension until finally your brain pieces together enough information that it goes pop and it snaps together. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. You see the floaty dolphin in the sea of green and you can't forget that that's a dolphin. You just saw it. That's what knowledge works like. We can't argue our way into knowledge. We can't analyze and dissect our way into knowledge. Well, we can, but it's hard. But mostly what we do is we just live in the uncomfortability of not knowing, and eventually our brains start to find patterns. And if we're lucky, the patterns are actually there. That's how our brains work, according to Polanyi. That was super helpful to me because it made me okay with this dissonance that was starting to build up in my head between what I believed and what actually worked. And I could say, you know what, I don't understand it yet, but I'm going to trust that this is real. I don't see how it all fits together yet, but I'm going to keep looking at it, and I'm going to live in the tension of it, and I'm going to trust that someday it's going to click, and then I'll be able to understand it, and I'll be able to explain it to people. So I stuck with it. And once again, I did the thing you can't ever do if you want to keep thinking the thing you already thought. I went and became a solo, small town, preacher man. And again, had to deal with real people with real problems. People who would say, I really don't want to die. Can you pray for me that I won't die? I don't want to have cancer anymore. Can you pray that I won't have cancer anymore? My child hates me. Can you pray that my child not hate me anymore? And once I knew which part of that answer I would have to justify, which one of those two answers I would have to explain away, I knew that I couldn't do this anymore because I was the one who needed help. It was my job to help people, and I was the one who needed help. But of course, when your livelihood and your family and your community, when everything depends on you believing the thing that you already believed, you can't think that thought. So you just live in the dissonance of it. And how do you deal with that kind of dissonance? Well, if you're a different kind of person, maybe it's sex, or maybe it's drugs, Now, I'm a nerd, so for me it's sci-fi and comedy. That was how I coped. That's how I still cope. I had people like Jon Stewart and Mark Twain and Isaac Asimov. Tim Minchin, I actually wrote to him. He didn't have a book. He's a musician. You can find him on YouTube. I actually wrote to him and he wrote back. Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams. And what I discovered, again, in a magic eye sort of way, a way that I couldn't predict and I didn't expect and it just popped, was what do these guys all have in common? Oh, they're all not believers. And the fact that they're not believers is part of what makes them so hilarious. Because they see the world sideways from everybody else. And they help us see things in different ways. So I had this place that would help me cope with not feeling right. And eventually, even that wasn't enough. And for the first time in my life, I saw that there was someplace else I could jump that wasn't death. Because that's what it's like, being a Christian minister, dedicating your entire life onto everything. You're standing on top of a 10-story pedestal, and it's the wind's blowing, and you're shaking, and you're like, no, it's fine. I like it up here. These guys and girls gave me hope that there was someplace else to jump, that I didn't have to stay up there. So I did, which left me entirely alone. And I needed help. And I found it in a group called the Clergy Project, which is an organization founded by Richard Dawkins and others to help people like me transition out of religion. In order to get in, you have to go through an interview process, and they asked me at that time, can you describe your level of belief or unbelief? And the way I explained it was, well, I can remember a time when belief was like the sun. And I can remember a time when belief was confusing. And I can remember a time when I was a believer who struggled with doubts. And I'd say now that I'm an unbeliever who struggles with belief. And that was good enough to get me in the door. So I became a part of that organization. And then I found you guys. And I found Sunday Assembly. And I found the Free Thought Congregation up in Sauk. And I started to build a new life. And it ain't bad. Today, I would self-identify as a humanist atheist. And right now, it feels just as sure and certain and reliable and helpful and necessary as the sunshine. So as I look back, that's my change. As I look back over that process, see a few things that stand out about how I was able to make that change. I needed people who respected themselves and me enough to be real, and I needed a safe way to explore ideas I wasn't comfortable with. So Robert and Penny didn't want me to be them. They wanted to sit and watch while I became the best me I could be, and because they loved me in that way, I wanted to be them. Going to a comedy show? It feels kind of aggressive, right? This guy's up, usually a guy, up there with a microphone, talking at you. It is safe as houses. No one forces you to go. You pay money to walk in the door, and then they sit you in the dark at a table, and you're medicated, 2-drink minimum. You're sitting in the dark in a corner. Someone's way up there away from you with a light all on them, and they throw out ideas at you. That's what you're buying when you pay for a stand-up comedy show. You're buying the opportunity for someone else to safely mess with your brain. Because they see things differently than you, and that's why you laugh. It's honest and it's gentle. So that's my advice for you today. If you want to change someone's mind, respect their agency. It's fragile. It's delicate. We go through life feeling like rational, independent individuals making decisions because reasons. And if we're really, really lucky, there is a small percentage of time where that's actually true. But most of the time, we're just trying to get through. And every once in a while, life confronts us with the fact that we're not in control and we're not 100% rational. And it really hurts. So we minimize those times when they happen. We run from them, we avoid them, and if we can't avoid them, we just get through it. If you can be the person who holds someone's hand while they walk through it, you are the greatest gift in the world to them. If you are strong enough and brave enough to accept other people and accept that they're different from you, be honest about who you are, and love them anyway, you are the greatest gift in the world to that person. Because they won't care what you know until they know that you care. And the day that they finally believe in their bones that you are in some way like them, that you are in some way on their side, that is the first day that they will hear the thing you've been saying for years. Thank you. My thought is that it brings me comfort and it helps me relax a little bit to recognize that really that whole shtick, it's about identity, not about what they think. And you know that's true because 6 years ago, they would have thought differently. And then this thing happened and their tribe went this way and so they went with their tribe. And it really is about identity. And when I recognize that I do the same thing, then I can cut them a little slack. That helps me relax a little bit, and that's good, in my opinion. We all want to be change agents, and so I would recommend two things, and both kind of from the recent experience of the LGBTQ community walking through a pretty radical shift, pretty radical 20-year shift. The thing that changed Grandma's mind was not a gay pride parade. The thing that changed Grandma's mind was that she loved her grandson. And her grandson was brave enough at great personal risk to be honest. And so she had to sit through however many years of dissonance to finally get to the point where the fact that she loved her grandson was more important than her preacher said. And because he was brave enough to do that, and because she was brave enough to answer that call, the entire society shifted in the space of 20 years. So that's the first thing that they did, is they lived out personally, but they also lived out publicly. And so I think one of the greatest gifts that we can give our brothers and sisters who disagree with us is a public face that is unashamed, but also pleasant. I am who I am, and I love you anyway. If we can say that and we can make them believe that, that's the day they start hearing us. To get back to the original question about Robert and Penny, that is the level of our relationship now, is that I can still be very proud and grateful of the way that they loved me as a person and helped me to grow as a human. And I can honor that all day long. The fact that I wound up believing a different thing from them is painful for them because of the thing in their head. And I'm sorry that hurts you. This is who I am. So we don't bring up that topic, but the other topics about community and love and getting along and thank you for loving me even when I was showing up at your door 17 times a week, like that we can still honor and find that common ground. One of the big turnings for me, it was the last time we were here, I told you guys about Dragon Games, about how, and it was it Sagan who talked about, I've got a dragon in my garage and you can't prove it's not there? You know, and you're like, well, you know, we could throw some flour in the air and it would settle on the dragon. And he's like, no, it's flour permeable. And then Eliezer Yudkowsky took that story and took it a step further, and he said, the fact that you already know which part of the test you need to justify means that part of you already knows the answer. So then I looked at my life and I thought, okay, Pastor, pray for me. I already know which outcome I'm going to need to justify. So part of me already knows the answer. That was what broke me out of it enough to see it. But it could have been what you said. It could have been, you don't have to fight that hard to explain that rocks fall. If I'd been smart enough to see it, I could have done it that way. I just didn't. I got in touch with Dan Barker pretty much right away, and Dan's answer was, you know, you're one of a whole lot of former ministers trying to find your way, and you know, like, if you were a lawyer, then we could hire you, but right now what you need to do is go get a real job. So that's what I did. Because they, you know, like, nobody's going to hire you to be a paid professional Greek participle parser. Like, that's never. Yeah. Yeah. And his advice was really good. You know, he said, you need to give up on trying to be a preacher anymore. That's not going to happen. You're not going to find enough atheist congregations out there to support you. You know, you need to find a real job, and if the real job, you know, sometime down the road involves you being a lawyer, then come see me and we'll work something out. We just last night were trying to get home. We went out to the farmer's market and then we came home and we couldn't get to our house because there were cars clogging the road. So we're coming up from Beloit. We live in Janesville. We came up and there's cars. So we went around and there's cars. And we went around and there's cars. And we came all the way over to here and we snuck through the cars into our neighborhood to get to our house. Because someone was kind enough to let us through into our neighborhood. Our entire neighborhood was encased in cars, like 3 miles thick. And the reason is because the credit union was giving away bricks from the old GM building. And not only did half the town show up, but we had people driving from Pennsylvania. You know, like, we had people driving from other GM plants because they lived in Janesville. And then when Janesville broke, they offered them. They said, you can take early retirement or you can move. Okay, so we're going to move. Well, they drove back from where they moved to so they could get a piece of this life that doesn't exist anymore. And the fact that they were willing to sit in their cars for 4 hours just to get a brick shows the loss and the pain and the amount of energy and motivation that's present in that loss and that pain. And if you think all of those people are still voting Democrat, you're ridiculous. Because the Democrats, in my opinion, had an opportunity to really back labor stronger than they did. And they missed that window. And so there's some labor that's still holding on, and there's some labor that says, screw you. We're done. And so they stopped self-identifying. That's what gets back to this. They stopped self-identifying as a member of the labor movement because they're like, my job's gone. The thing that was supposed to keep me safe failed. I can't do this anymore. I have to go pick at Amazon for 14 hours a day at $7.95 an hour with no benefits, and then the computer tells me I'm doing it too slow because I can't even talk to a manager because it's run by a robot, and then I get fired. That's my life now. I used to work for GM. So that person is furious, and yeah, absolutely, I think some of them transferred over to just to support the screw you party. I think that's real. I think most of what we believe, or I shouldn't say most of what we believe, we have an innate wiring that makes us prone to believing what the tribe believes. So if we have that, just because you have that wiring doesn't mean you can't overcome it. You can. It just means you have to work at it. And it means over time you're going to drift toward the crowd. So like we have to fight against it. So the beliefs, while the beliefs aren't grounded in identity, like they are influenced continually by identity, which is why I think if we want to make long-lasting change, it has to start with identity. I will be here afterwards. I will absolutely talk to anybody who wants to talk to me. And we do have the humanist organization afterwards. They'll be doing a Q&A. Please bring questions then. Okay?
Our closing words for today are 1 and 1 make 11. Join your neighbors, say hello, have coffee, and come to the humanist meeting and get to talk next door and get to talk more with Bob. Thanks.